This is the Elevate Podcast, where trial lawyers learn, share, and grow. Let's talk about how we can elevate our trial practices, law firms, and lives. And now, here are your hosts, coming to you from coast to coast, trial lawyers Ben Gideon and Rahul Ravipudi.
Today's episode of the Elevate Podcast is being brought to you by Smart Advocate. Smart Advocate is award-winning case management software used to manage personal injury, medical malpractice, MDL, class action law firms all over the United States. Great program, highly recommend it. Check them out at smartadvocate.com. Today's episode is being brought to you by Expert Institute. Expert Institute is the place to go for everything involving experts to help you win your case. Check them out at expertinstitute.com. And today's episode is being brought to you by Hype Legal. Hype Legal is a one-stop shop for all of your digital marketing needs. Check them out at hypelegal.com.
Welcome to the Elevate Podcast. I'm Rahul Ravipudi.
I'm Ben Gideon. So, hey, Rahul. Back from your $46 million verdict. We talked about that a little bit last time. What have you done to decompress and get back to the swing of things?
Oh, I've been coaching flag football. And I know Susan says we talk about football a lot on this, but this is kids flag football. And I'm really, really effective at it. So I'm on a streak. It's been a season and a half. And between my two kids, 14 and 11, we've won zero games. So the largest loss has been 60-0, and the closest we did lose by a couple points once. So I think coaching's in my future.
What do you think the secret to your lack of success has been?
I think it's a lack of preparation, planning, and inspiration. That would be my trifecta to success.
Do you play all the kids, give them all equal time, or do you just play like the superstars the most?
We've lost every game, Ben. No, we play equal time, but this is actually the amazing thing. I've been coaching for a season and a half, right? All of the kids from the first season kept tapping me on the shoulder asking if I'm going to coach next season. I don't even know how that's possible. But at least I got the headspace of all of these kids to realize that it's all about having fun and getting better and not necessarily all about winning, at least yet. So that's been fun.
I think they're asking you because there's movement towards firing the coach and hiring a new coach.
That's probably true, too.
So are you really coaching next season after performance?
I got to learn to read the room and the inflection points. You're right.
So it's my great pleasure to invite Susan Fonts and Jody Nofsinger to the podcast today. Not only are they terrific trial lawyers from my home state of Maine, but we were partners in the same law firm for many years together and good friends. So welcome, Susan and Jody.
Thank you, Ben.
Thank you, Ben. And Rahul, we're really excited to be here.
Before we jump into your trial practice, and we know there's a recent verdict we want to talk about, maybe some other verdicts, but each of you, I know from knowing you, but our listeners don't, have your own kind of interesting background and story in terms of how you got into becoming a lawyer and particularly a trial lawyer. So can you each kind of give us a little bit of a sense for that and your own stories?
Susan, you go first.
Sure. So I grew up with a single mother who was Korean. And I think one of the moments that I had in my life was early on when my parents were getting divorced. And at that time, they didn't have court interpreters. And so I would go to court with my mom. And through that experience was the first time that I saw, you know, my mom had a divorce lawyer who was a female. And in my eyes, that was like my first experience of seeing a woman who was sort of in this position of power, who also was just really a great advocate for my mother, who barely spoke English at the time. And that just left this impression in my mind. And obviously, I was 7 or 8 at the time. And I just had this impression of, oh, maybe I want to be a lawyer one day, but I really did not have any understanding of what that entailed. Neither of my parents went to college. They both didn't finish high school. And just as life moved forward, that was just something in the back of my mind. I graduated from college. I still had that in my mind that, you know, maybe I wanted to go to law school. And so I was not quite sure. I worked as a paralegal at a big Boston law firm to get a better sense of what does the law entail? What do lawyers do? I enjoyed that experience a lot, but I also realized that I did not want to work at a big law firm in a big city. I think, you know, one of the things that I was really interested in was trying to get into a courtroom. And then when I was in law school, I actually worked at a family law firm, actually Taylor's dad's firm. And I really enjoyed that experience. I thought I wanted to get into family law. As I was graduating from law school, there was no opportunities. I took a trial practice class, which I really enjoyed. I didn't know if I would enjoy that, but I did. And then I tried out for the trial team while I was in law school. Jody was one of the coaches for the trial team. And I remember when I tried out for the trial team, I had to actually do an opening. And just coincidentally, Berman and Simmons was having on-campus interviews at the time. And Jody was the person who was doing the on-campus interviews. And so when I walked in for my interview for Berman and Simmons, Jody said, "You can relax. I've already seen you do your opening. You're going to go on to the second round." So that was sort of the beginning of my career path, I guess.
Okay. Well, I'll go. So I'm the youngest of 7 kids. My mom was actually married twice, had 5 kids, and then a hiatus, and then remarried and had 2 kids with my dad. And I was born in Rockford, Illinois, which back in the early 80s was like the most depressed area in the country. And my mom had a number of careers in the law. I mean, legal secretary for many, many years. But she ended up becoming a clerk in the Social Security Appeals Court during the Reagan administration, when Reagan suspended, there was a moratorium on anybody getting ongoing benefits without having to appeal. So every claim was denied for a period of a few years. And so my mom would sit in that courtroom, and then she'd come home and talk about all of the horribly injured, disabled people that had to be without benefits for a long period of time. And I think it sort of inculcated me into sort of like this tendency towards people that really need help. Which is funny because my mother wasn't necessarily an entirely helpful person, rest her soul, and had her own difficult behaviors. And then I was a science kid, though. I was convinced that I wanted to be a doctor, mostly just because I love the science. So I went to the University of Illinois for college and was a pre-med major. In about the second year, I became a little disaffected about that because from what I could see, all the other pre-med students were not really going into medicine for the right reasons. And I remember thinking, I can't handle these being, you know, my colleagues. I mean, come on. And so I finished out with a biology degree because it's what I loved. And then I had this idea, you know, once I graduated, I really had no idea. Spent a couple of years doing various jobs, mostly for professors in the genetics department at the University of Illinois. And then decided I needed to do something. So I was just like, let's try law school, see what happens there. And then again, I picked something that made sense to me. One of my sisters was living in Maine and had small children, and we were very close. And I ended up deciding that Maine must have a law school and never went to look at it, never got any information, just made the application. And I started there in 1993. I was on the trial team. My partner and I were the winners of the New England Regional in our year. And then from there, I will also say that in law school, I got the opportunity to spend a summer clerking with Mary Bonato, who is the attorney that argued the gay marriage case in front of the United States Supreme Court, and really the creator of enormously important decisions in the area of LGBT rights. And I said, I want to be you. And she said, you just need to get a job somewhere and do a lot of work. She said, that's how you do it, because that's what she did. In fact, she worked at Middle Aysen, the same law firm that Susan worked at, and then ultimately ended up getting the position at GLAD. And she's a hero, quite honestly. But she told me, just get a job at a firm and try lots of cases. That's what she said. And then I was like, I want to be working down in Boston with you. And ultimately, that's not what happened. I came to Berman and Simmons, a hell of a lot of experience with a hell of a lot of jury trials and also district court practice in front of a judge. And so here I am, and I truly, truly love what I do for work.
Jody, one thing that I know about your the beginning of your career is when you started and first came to Berman and Simmons, you were immediately staffed on, I think it was a first multiple homicide, first degree murder trial, and a case that became so high profile that they did a Dateline show about it, right? Or one of those news magazine shows. That must have been pretty amazing to start your career working on that case. And do you want to just tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I had been offered the position. I was clerking for the Superior Court at the time in Maine. And I applied, interviewed, got through the gauntlet of all of the lawyers I had to. Ben, you probably had the same experience. You had to meet like five people. And then
you being one of them, by the way.
Oh, well, you got lucky then. And basically accepted the position, and I had months of lead time because I got hired in, I think, like January. And then this triple homicide occurred in Portland. And basically it was being described as an execution style killing spree. And Jack Simmons got the case, and I read about that in the newspaper. I was like, oh God, really? And he started calling me. He said, when is your clerkship done? And I said, I've told you it's done at the end of July. And then he said, well, when are you going to start working? I said, we've already talked about this. I'm taking the month of August off. And he's like, well, you know, I got this case. And I said, I'm aware you got this case. And he said, so you're going to come on August 1st. And I said, no, I'm coming the day after Labor Day. And he hung up on me. that's essentially how that went. But yeah, for the first like 3.5 months of my career here, I was almost 100% of my time assimilating all of the discovery in that case, because Jack had a way of entrusting people with things and working with a private investigator and talking to an awful lot of shady characters, essentially provide us with information about what the terrible acts that these three people who died in that incident had perpetrated around the city of Portland. And yeah, and it actually went to trial within 6 months of the day of the event itself. So it was quite a wild ride, and that got done. And then I found January kind of boring, as I was mostly doing whiplash cases.
But you buried the headline there because you managed to achieve an acquittal, right?
True. It was all ultimately, how do I put it? The jurors were not convinced enough that it wasn't self-defense to actually convict him.
These three guys showed up at the defendant's home, right?
Yes.
And then the defendant shot and killed all three of them, including one of them who was in the process of driving away when shot. Is that accurate?
It's not completely accurate, actually. That was the storyline from the Portland police. But in fact, he was essentially sort of spinning his wheels and revving the engine. And our client was able to tell us that what he saw was one who was in the driver's seat after the other two had been shot was reaching into the back seat. So he hadn't actually tried to move at all. He had that whole gas brake thing going on. In essence, when we got all the photographs, the car was full of junk, but in the back was a pretty thick, long wooden dowel that was back there. And I don't think this guy was a carpenter. And so we asked for all the photos of the inside of the car, and lo and behold, I found this dowel that was back there. I think that, quite honestly, was probably the key thing to him being exonerated for that particular shooting.
What's the import of the dowel?
Well, it's a hard wooden, it's like a baseball bat. I mean,
weapon.
Yep. And we had actually, from interviewing a lot of people that had been physically harmed by these three, that they had, and that was actually something that popped up in at least one interview with somebody about they hit him with the wooden dowel. I don't know. I mean, baseball bats seem pretty effective, but I guess they were into the dowel for whatever reason.
The Maine's such a small place that we all know each other here in some degree of separation. But the defendant in that case, whose name was Sabino Raya, was my home ec partner in seventh grade. We had home economics where we would do things like sewing and making things like cooking. We made whoopie pies together, Sabino and I. Little did I know he would go on to shoot dead three people later, but.
Yep. And then he left the state, moved south, and has had a very successful career in selling Toyotas.
So you guys have tried multiple cases together now, medical malpractice cases. Can you talk about the team approach that you've developed to trying cases and why you think that's been successful and how you break up the labor before and during the trial?
So, well, I'll just say, you know, I was trying to think about this in preparation for today. And Jody and I were talking about this as we approached this particular case. Like, I think we have tried almost like 10 cases together. And I think part of this is relational between Jody and I. And I think our relationship has evolved over time. You know, as I said at the beginning of the podcast, originally, you know, I saw Jody as sort of like my professor slash mentor. There were a number of years at the firm where I worked with Jody in her practice. I now work in my own practice. So when we initially tried cases together, it was like I definitely took more of a backseat, a secondary role, kind of let Jody obviously take the lead. And it was more in this role of observer. But I felt like this trial, it was sort of the culmination of our relationship. And so it was nice in that way. This was a case that Jody had been working on for years. She invited me to work with her on this case. I think the benefit of us working together is that we just kind of know the rhythms of each other. So it's easy in that way. I can kind of anticipate in some ways what Jody might be thinking about something or what Jody might need. And so I can sort of address that as we approach trial. In terms of dividing the work, I sort of deferred to Jody because this was the case that she had that she invited me to work on. And so in this particular case, I agreed to do the examination of the cardiology expert and then also handle the economic experts, which, you know, lots of challenges with economic experts. And we can talk about that in a bit. And then a couple of the damages witnesses. So it was really just a nice way to work with Jody on this trial, just because, like I said, I feel like we have tried so many cases together that we understand sort of the rhythms of each other and we know sort of what to anticipate from each other. And where I am weak, she is strong. And where she is weak, I am strong. And I just felt like it was a really good compliment to try this case together.
We'd like to thank the sponsors of the Elevate podcast, Steno, National court reporting service that allows trial lawyers to defer the costs of court reporting until the end of the case. Take a look, steno.com. And by Law Pods. Law Pods is the podcast production company that we use to produce the show that produces podcasts for lawyers all over the country. They have an expertise in podcasting and the law. Check them out at lawpods.com.
Do you want to give us a little bit of the backstory? This is a case you tried earlier this year in 2023, and it was a medical malpractice case. You got a $6.5 million verdict, right, in Cumberland County, Maine. And can you just tell us a little bit about the facts of the case and the backstory to it?
Yeah. So this case first came into the firm from an attorney in Pennsylvania, because the family in question was from Pennsylvania. And initially, it went to our managing partner, Craig Bramley, who did an initial review. And then he said, I see in your calendar that you're supposed to be in Philadelphia next week. Can you meet with these people down there? And I said, okay, yep, I'll do that. And the case was about a family from Quakertown, Pennsylvania. And they had 6 kids. It concerns the oldest kid, Peter. Peter was one of those kids who wasn't necessarily a classically successful academic critter when he was younger. He had potentially some learning disabilities. He wasn't all that engaged. And then at some point, he caught fire. And what I mean by that is that he, in high school, had a teacher who was knew all the business applications. So he really became very interested in accounting of all things. And was really passionate about it, yet his grades were very unimpressive. He graduated from high school, he went to the local community college, and he started to seriously study accounting. And then after a couple of years in community college, he managed to transfer to Temple University, which is a fairly, you know, good school. And from there, he just worked and worked and worked. He had this intense work ethic about getting to where he needed to be the person that he wanted to be. And then ultimately, he ended up landing a summer internship at one of the big four accounting firms, which was astonishing. And part of all of that for him was just that he, of course, we don't get to know these people, right? But we get to hear about them from everybody around them. And he apparently was one of the most charming, kind, sort of present people you can imagine. And so he was just a very attractive person, you know, in almost every way possible, who at the same time just needed to constantly, constantly work hard to have so he could acquire the skill set he needed, whereas others might have had some of those skill sets just, you know, as part of their DNA. So hard worker and just beloved by, I think, everybody. I mean, it's amazing. So he, in his work with the accounting firm that he was working for, he was sent up to Maine for a project that his employer was handling related to a big company in Maine. And so they were up here doing an audit that was going to be a long-term audit. Unbeknownst to him, somewhere or another, he got bitten by a tick. And he apparently had no awareness of that. And then what ended up happening is in June of 2017, when this all really unfolded, he went to the hospital because he had this weird rash in multiple spots on his body. And unfortunately, he was not investigated for anything that was related to ticks, more or less. The only thing that's really in the record around this is, you know, denies tick bite. But it's very, very common statistically for people who have been bitten by a tick to be unaware of it. And so more or less, the doctor, I think, was suspicious of him maybe being engaged in some kind of risky lifestyle choices, is how I'd put it, and ended up deciding that he must just have a weird virus, unknown virus, that is causing this rash. And he put him on acyclovir, which is what you give for somebody if you think they have herpes, even though he had never had a herpes outbreak, which aren't usually all that subtle. And sent him home, and he took the medication, and, you know, it affected a little bit. I mean, it wasn't really healing anything. And then a number of days later, he goes back, and now the rashes are huge. And this time, the doctor diagnoses him with hives. Hives are typically incredibly itchy little buggers, and he had no complaints of itching, and he referred him to a dermatologist. 5 days later, Pete collapsed at the hotel where he was staying long-term. And essentially his heart rate went down into the 20s and 30s because he had heart block because Lyme disease had gotten into his heart and was affecting the node that regulates your pulse. And he managed to crawl to his hotel room and call rescue and ended up at Maine Medical Center. There he was promptly diagnosed just based upon his history. And he had to have an external pacemaker placed to regulate his rhythm, and they started him on acyclovir. I'm sorry, not acyclovir. They started him on an antibiotic that is doxycycline, which is the one that is most commonly used to treat Lyme disease. And they were able to get him sort of safely out of the heart block, and they discharged him home. But once you have the amount of damage he had in his heart, there's no guarantees. And so a couple of days later, he traveled home to Pennsylvania to recuperate with his family, and he collapsed at home and could not be resuscitated.
That was actually one of the challenging aspects of the case. When he collapsed at home, he actually had ventricular fibrillation, kind of like Damar Hamlin from the Buffalo Bills. And so there was this gap in time of he had been discharged on the 29th. He then passed away on July 2nd. And so there was this gap in time where we're saying he got released from a different hospital. They had safely treated him. They had done everything right. But then a few days passed and he died. And we sort of had to explain that to the jury of, how could this happen? And how is this not some other random event? How is this related to the untreated Lyme disease? And that was something that we had to very carefully get through our cardiology expert. And fortunately, you know, Jody, who had prosecuted this case before I got involved, was smart enough to make sure that we had a cardiology expert involved in the case early on.
So who were the defendants in the case? The doctor who failed to timely diagnose the Lyme disease? And then what about, was there any allegation or charge of premature discharge, allowing him to go home?
Yeah. So the first presentation was to a walk-in clinic at Mercy Hospital, which is in Portland. And the second one, I think our client Pete basically said, not sure about that doctor. I'm going to go to the Mercy Hospital emergency room this time. But unfortunately, the same doctor was there. He was staffing the ER that day. So the case against, there are two large sort of hospital conglomerate groups in Maine. One is Maine Health, and the other one is essentially the Eastern Maine Health folks, which have a bunch of hospitals over the state. So he was part of a larger network of, I think, I haven't remembered, if I remember correctly, I think Eastern Maine might have up to 8 hospitals, Ben. That's kind of my memory of that. So it was a pretty big system. And, you know, this gentleman was certainly up there in years in terms of his, where he was in his career.
Susan, you mentioned you cross-examined their cardiologist. Am I wrong about that? Or?
Yeah, so they did not have a cardiologist.
Oh, they didn't.
And just to clarify, I mean, he went to Maine Medical Center, which is a different hospital, and that's where they appropriately diagnosed him with the Lyme disease and treated him for his heart block. And he was at a point where, you know, our cardiology expert said he could be discharged. So the assumption, if I was sitting on the jury, would be, well, he should have been fine. They fixed his problem. He was just recouping. But then why did he suddenly drop dead? And we had to explain that.
Who did you cross? I know the economist and there was a medical person.
The cardiologist.
Oh, the treating cardiologist.
Yes. I presented our.
Oh, you presented your cardiologist. I see. So what were their defenses? Did they have any defenses on the liability issues?
They did. I mean, essentially, the defense was more or less their expert, who is someone he's from Boston, and he seems like a very lovely person, and he does all this humanitarian aid work. He's often overseas.
Is that Dr. Van Royen?
Yes.
We've seen him as well.
Yes. Well, yes, when I deposed him, I will say he was sitting like in a wingback chair wearing a vest, and I thought it was Oscar Wilde.
He's a handsome man.
Yes, that is true. Effectively, he was the only medical expert for the defense side. My guess is that they had perhaps consulted with a cardiologist who said, I can't help you. But, you know, so that was it. And then also, they also had Chris Bartlett. I don't know if you've been encountering Chris Bartlett. He seems to be the economist du jour for the defense in Maine. And so those are their only two experts.
Can I ask you about voir dire? You guys had an opportunity to do some lawyer-directed voir dire, which Rahul is really the expert on. I know everything I know about voir dire from him. But what were you allowed to do, and what do you think you were able to accomplish through the voir dire process?
So that was my first time, Ben, doing an actual voir dire process in front of a jury. I would say that it's going to take some iterations to feel really comfortable in that. It was remarkable to me how I've stood in front of jurors many, many times in my career, but I've never stood in front of jurors and had them interact with me. And it's a little bit shocking when it first starts happening, right? There were a few things that we were concerned about, but the thing we were most concerned about was there was a piece in the medical records about our client's first presentation to the hospital, which is the walk-in clinic where he was first seen. He was a very candid young man. And in the history that is recorded in the doctor's note, essentially, the doctor's note said, was in New York City 5 days ago, did some cocaine. And that piece of it, I remember thinking, if I try to get this excluded, I think that the defense is going to have a very strong argument that the clinical picture as the patient presents, including risky behaviors they might be engaged in, was why he sort of went down this route of thinking that this was possibly an STD issue, risky lifestyle and potential consequences from that risky lifestyle. So I don't think we really seriously even considered trying to keep the cocaine out. And because I knew that was probably an uphill argument, and I was trying instead to figure out what to do with it. So I think the most powerful part of the attorney director of voir dire in this case was me basically saying, you're going to hear that 5 days before our client went to the hospital for the first time, I said he readily admitted to the physician that he did cocaine 5 days earlier. And I said some people, and this is, I'm not taking my mother's name in vain here. Some people, like my mother, had absolutely no tolerance for anyone who used illegal drugs, right? And other people think, well, things like that happen. And what does it mean in terms of the case? And so, and people were pretty candid. They had no problem being like my mom when they heard that information. And I think, honestly, that was one of the things that I was worried about the most in the case. We were also worried about, there's always some kind of inference that people want to make. Like, for example, against Maine Medical Center, why'd they send him home? Obviously, he wasn't stable. But I mean, you could see people doing that because we know that jurors, like to find they think is the key to why they're going to vote a certain way. But it was intimidating. And so it was hard, I think, to really start your first interaction with the jurors in that setting. The last time I did it was at the Don Keenan workshop, Ben, years ago in Freeport.
I remember that.
Yeah.
And Don was yelling at us, right?
Would you have been able to ask the court to ask that very same question you got to do in the attorney-directed voir dire?
I'm sure that that would have been dealt with if we'd had, essentially the court saying no to letting the lawyers do it. We got lucky, though. The judge who handled the trial, it was O'Neill then, and he was very open to it. It was the first time he had seen it done. And I think the judges, have a lot of concerns about doing this. I think there are some judges that simply will not ever permit it in Maine, which is their, that's their choice. But I think that the more we can have successful uses of it, the more that's going to help, I think. But honestly, the other best thing about it is you get to start to have a relationship with these people right away. And although I have to say that Phil, the defense counsel, was very charming with them. And I was like, man, he is so much better at this than I am.
What did he do during voir dire?
I mean, not much really, but he was just, he's very relational. Phil can be very charming. And he did really well in that process. I mean, for example, he had a smile on his face the whole time. I'm pretty sure I did not. But it's just neat because you get to talk to them. And some of those folks that did speak up ended up being on our jury. And then I felt like it was weird that I couldn't talk to them any longer. And you just had to watch them.
I will say, though, just, I obviously was observing and taking notes. And that was my first experience with open court voir dire. And just even watching people's body language, initially, everyone seems very kind of like, what's going on? A little bit standoffish. And then as the questions go on, you can see them start to open up and move closer in and want to participate. And then it just all culminized into when Jody did her opening and she mentions the cocaine and everyone's like, oh yeah, cocaine, we've already heard about that. No big deal. It was just one of those great moments of like, this is why voir dire is so beneficial.
So Jody, your example of what you were able to accomplish and the defense counsel is like a perfect juxtaposition of, I think, the old school voir dire style of trying to be friendly and make them all your buddies, which is what Phil did, and new school, which is what you did in identifying people with actual biases and having them be open and honest about that and getting them off for cause, and just trying to be their friend doesn't get them to change their life experiences or biases and doesn't get them to side Phil's way, apparently. So hopefully the judge talks to other judges and says this was actually useful in identifying things that are important for a Seventh Amendment right to a jury trial. Nicely done.
One of the observations I've made in doing this in the last few trials is the although the lawyers have never done it before or have not done it much because it hasn't been allowed in Maine up until now, the jurors don't know that. So they're really just the same as jurors in any state. For all they know, we've done this forever. So, I mean, I don't think they respond any differently to voir dire than they would if they were in a different state, other than maybe just the fact that they're, you know, New Englanders versus Californians. But so it's really us on the lawyer side that have to become comfortable with it. But the jurors will respond whatever way, hope they would if you did it the way it should be done. No, that's great. I mean, I agree that the more judges that have a positive experience with it, it seems like we're gaining momentum and people are recognizing that it has real value. So tell us about, you wanted to talk about the, I know the economic issue is a big issue in your case. And I think a lot of our listeners deal with economists or trying to present economic loss damages in cases and probably confront similar issues. So do you want to talk a little bit about that issue?
But let me just say that the case is on appeal to the state Supreme Court, and it's really on appeal only around the economic damages claim. As Ben is well aware, a number of years ago, the Maine, basically the wrongful death statute in Maine, required that if economic damages could only be claimed by a spouse or minor children. That was amended, I believe it was in 2009, if I have my dates correctly. Oh no, it wasn't that long ago. I forget which year it was. But that was amended to delete the requirement of basically spouse and dependent children without any real explanation. But it was certainly intentional. And I just know about that because of being on the Maine Trial Lawyers Board at that time. But essentially, since that happened, in terms of how that has worked in the court system, the examples have been few and far between. Ben will remember that I had a hayride crash where a teenager died. She was a junior in high school, but had every intention of having a career in medicine. And in that case, I pushed the economic loss claim on the defense. In essence, they ended up paying for essentially the full value of the economic loss claim. In that case, they didn't challenge it. So they ended up resolving that case with that included. So when I raised the claim in this case, that became a major issue. The case went through summary judgment around whether parents can be beneficiaries of a decedent's lost income claim. And the judge denied that motion for summary judgment and decided it in our favor, and had to decide it in our favor like six times during the trial too, because they raised it all the time to make sure they preserved their rights on appeal. And so now that is in the initial phases of review with the state Supreme Court.
How would that work in California, Rahul? Can you recover economic losses in a death case even if there's no dependent children or spouse?
Yes.
So that would just go to the next of kin, whoever that is?
Yeah. It's derivative of the wrongful death claim.
And Susan, so what was going on with their economics expert?
Well, I mean, I think just generally the challenge of putting on an economic expert is it's not the most exciting part of trial, right? So first of all, I was trying to think through, you know, how am I going to do the direct of our own economic expert? And as you probably know, you know, both working with economic experts, they want to get into the real nitty gritty of the number crunching, which jury doesn't necessarily want to hear. And my goal in trying to put on our economic expert was, how can I move through this quickly? Obviously, there's some information I need to get out because I knew that this appeal would potentially be pending. But then also, how can I just basically get to the final numbers and get it in a place where it will somehow remain with the jury? And even in prepping with the economic expert, it's like I would try to get him focused and he would want to get into the RPN calculation. And I'm thinking I'm having a hard time understanding this. The jury is not going to understand this. That was the challenge. Our economic expert had three scenarios. In our case, Pete was working as an auditor for KPMG, but he actually hadn't attained his CPA degree yet. And so that was one of the arguments that the defense was making. You know, you can't claim that he'd be making what a CPA was going to make because he wasn't a CPA. So our economic expert had three different scenarios, and I had to sort of present those numbers. And ultimately, I tried to just do that in a So you took this number and you multiply by this number, and you know, this is the number that you got, and put it up on a flip chart. Here's scenario one, here's scenario two, here's scenario three. You know, jury, you can pick from whatever these scenarios you want to pick from. And then the defense had an economic expert who, again, it's really just about methodology, differences in methodologies in terms of how they come up with different calculations. I just tried to highlight the points that we agreed with. If there were any differences and it was just really minor differences, I tried to point that out. And then ultimately the jury had basically those two sets of numbers. And I think what they did was basically split the difference and pick the number. But it is, and I, the whole time I'm doing the direct of our economic expert, I kept glancing at the jury to see, like, is anyone falling asleep? Like, let's get through this, you know? And how can I try to make this interesting for them?
Remember in the old days, Jody, we had an economic loss expert named Alan McCausland, Dr. McCausland, and he was very gregarious and animated. So he would, I mean, and he just loved this stuff. So he would get up there and flail his arms about, and he was actually somewhat entertaining. But since Alan retired, I don't think we found anybody with that same level of entertainment value to breathe life into the economic losses.
That also reminds me is, I think this was one of my first trials. I had another trial before this, post-pandemic. So I felt very rusty, not for this trial, but the first trial, I felt very rusty because we hadn't been in trial for like 2.5 years. And there was a lot of nervousness associated with that. But I noticed with this trial, that the Smith trial, we used many different mediums. Like, some of our witnesses were live, some of our witnesses were on Zoom. Even with the economic expert, he was there live, but I was showing things on a, you know, on the screen, but then we were also using the flip chart. I just noticed that we had to use a lot more mediums to keep the jury engaged and entertained. And I felt like that was intensified post-pandemic as opposed to pre-pandemic. I don't know if Raul or Ben, you feel that way now with trials post-pandemic, but I definitely think that's an element that we have to think about as we move forward.
Definitely makes things, I think, more efficient, but the pandemic, at least for us Californians, it made jurors okay with seeing people on video screens, as opposed to whether it's my own psychological barrier or just receptiveness. The concept of having somebody appear remotely for a trial testimony before the pandemic would have been unacceptable to me. And because I was afraid that they would be disconnected to the jury, and I don't see that anymore.
Yeah, it's almost like they expect it, right? We're so used to using all these different formats now that the jury expects it, and it kind of breaks up the monotony.
Yep.
I was worried because the only expert we had that really, really mattered, which was our emergency room expert, it was a hitch with regard to the trial scheduling. And so she ended up having to testify via Zoom. And I remember thinking, oh, that was like, to me, it's like anyone but her, right? Anyone but her. But it really did think it went well. I mean, and certainly, and we were in the old Superior Court, Ben, which is not exactly the best courtroom for doing a jury trial because of the way it's laid out, because the people are so, jury is pretty far away from the actual witness box.
Is that courtroom 11?
Yeah. So I think they probably heard her and saw her much more readily than the people that were sitting in the witness stand.
That's an interesting observation. I've had a similar scare where our principal standard of care expert for the trial that I did a week or two before yours didn't have such a good result. But at the last minute, my expert said he couldn't make it up for the trial date, and we were scrambling to present him by remotely. Ultimately, he was able to work it out and come, but maybe it would have been better if he didn't. But it's interesting that that really is a viable option now, perhaps in some cases, maybe a better option.
Yeah. And some of our witnesses, by the way, were from Pennsylvania. So the family came up, but essentially his coworkers, a teacher of his from the high school accounting class testified via Zoom. It was one of my first real experiences with having a whole cast of characters sort of telling little parts of the story. And Zoom made it so much more workable for those folks.
So congrats again on that verdict.
Yeah.
Moving away from the specific case in the last few minutes, 10 minutes or so that we have, both of you have achieved a lot of success in your careers as trial lawyers over many years and many different cases and trials. For our listeners who may be newer lawyers or looking for pointers, tips, things you've learned along the way, what are some of the big takeaways you have or advice you could give to other lawyers who are looking to achieve that same level of success that you have?
I knew in law school I wanted to be a trial lawyer, and I was just trying to figure out what was the best pathway for that. Working with Mary Bonato, I think, was great because she essentially told me, get the hell out of here and just go someplace where you get to try cases. You get to deal with real people and you get to try cases. It was a little bit tough my year of law school, which I graduated in 1996, because I had worked at Gay and Lesbian Advocates and Defenders. And I remember talking with Mary Bonato about the implications of listing that on my resume. She said there was a lot of data at that point in time. You were very, very unlikely to be hired if you're out on your resume. And so she gave me the sanitized name of GLAAD at the time, which was Park Square Advocates, Inc. And I dropped a couple of resumes with that for the first couple of weeks. And then I was like, this feels like a lie to me. I just can't do it. And so literally, I only got two interviews coming out of my clerkship. And one was with Drummond Woodsum, and it was Melissa Huey. And that was a soft audience for me, except she mostly did employment discrimination. And I remember having a conversation with her about, what would you do if your client said this to you? And I'd be like, yeah, I don't know what I would do with that. And then the other interview I got was with Jack Simmons. And, you know, so that was sort of the history from there. Mary's partner, Jenny Riggins, had worked at Berman and Simmons for a period of years. And so Jack was, I didn't know that about that at the time. But so I got to work with Jack, and I listened to Mary, and I just did all kinds of things. I did criminal defense. I did family law, which I didn't really enjoy. I did small claims. I did unemployment appeals cases. I did whatever got thrown my way, I was just doing it. And I think that that's, give me quite honestly, I am an introvert and I have a level of shyness. Just being in that position where it wasn't about me and it was about other people was the right position for me. I didn't have to talk about myself. I didn't have to put myself out there, but, you know, instead had people sort of entrust me with whatever this big problem is that they were having. And so I think I just really learned how to listen to people and how to figure out what they needed around, and it, not just the results of the case, but the process of the case, and really just kind of fell in love with being someone who can be in this position of just helping people with whatever problem they're having.
I think for me, the advice I would give is just do it. Don't worry about losing. I think that's a big thing to think about. And I know that you guys recently talked about the importance of talking about losing trials, not just winning trials. And go back to this trial specifically, I said that my first trial post-pandemic had a trial that we lost. And of course, no one likes losing, but it was great to sort of have that opportunity to get back into the courtroom, to kept saying to get all my rusties out, just understand sort of the minutiae of a trial, and also just physically condition yourself to be back in trial, because there's a different level of physical challenge when you're in trial. And I realized how that had really been lost during the pandemic. And I don't want to go that long of a period again without trying a case, because each case, whether you win or lose, you learn so much from it. And for me, you know, I'm always just curious to learn new techniques or hear about other people's techniques that maybe I try that I fail and realize that's not going to work for me. I need to find something else that works for me. And just trying to find sort of that level of what works for me and how do I make sure that I'm able to exert my own voice so I can be the best advocate that I can be for my clients.
Last question. What is your favorite aspect of trial and why?
For me, I feel like as we prepare for trial, we really get to know our clients. We get to know them sort of in and out. We get to, you know their family, their friends, their coworkers. And I think that's really the motivating factor for me. But then being in trial itself, I don't know, it's just gives me an adrenaline rush. It's exhausting. You're tired. There's highs and lows. But I think that's one of the great things about trying a case with somebody else. It's like you have somebody there with you. You have someone there that you can sort of talk things out with. And you might be seeing evidence a certain way, but the other person sees the evidence a different way. And you can have a discussion about that. So I just love, I don't know, I just love all aspects of it, I guess.
For me, that answer is not just about the trial setting, but it's about from the first interaction with the client in the case, which is, I really do want people to understand that they can put themselves in my hands and I will do my best for them. And there's a degree in which sort of starting the relationship in that way, which is, you know, sort of a, I've got you. Okay. In the course of my career, I have just seen that that reduces, or if they believe you, which I think they usually do, it reduces some of the anxieties they have about, you know, listen, I would be a terrible client, I think. I think that I would be lots of questions, lots of what about this and all of these things. But I really want them to understand that it's just, this is my job. It is my job to take care of this problem for them as best that I can. And that sort of relational aspect of it to me, it really culminates, you know, all the more in the trial setting, when especially when you're prepping with your clients for trial. Dason trial, which Susan and I did, now I guess probably 5 years ago, it's been a while. Those clients were just sort of salt of the earth, Mainers, hunting, fishing, all of that stuff. And so it's not necessarily a background that everybody in Maine has, but I just find a way to connect with them about what matters in their lives. And then, you know, sort of have that, there's an intimacy to being in that position with clients. And that's the part that just sort of carries me through the whole thing, usually, is every one of those connection points.
Well, thank you guys so much for joining us. Spending this hour with you makes me miss you guys.
You're just across the river, man.
Just across the river, but, you know, it's a wide and strong river. But yeah, no, it's great talking to you and hearing from you. And I hope you guys will go on and have other great verdicts and can come back on and share them with us again. And if folks want to reach out or, you know, have questions for you, want to talk to you about the case or other cases, tell them how to reach you.
Okay. Well, the firm's telephone number is 207-3576. I'm sorry. Oops, I missed the 784. Excuse me, 207-784-3576. I never call it.
I probably wouldn't have remembered it, even though I was, for 17 years, that was my phone number.
Thank you very much for having us on here, Ben. I know that I was joking with you when I said, so when are you going to have us on your podcast? And I was absolutely joking. So thank you for taking the time to get us on here. And Rahul, like I said, it was very exciting to meet you. I felt like I was meeting a celebrity after listening to all those podcasts.
Congratulations to both of you on all of your success now and in your continued success in the future. It's fantastic.
For more information about today's guests and the topics discussed on the show, please visit our website at www.elevate.net. That's ELAWBATE.net, where you'll find guest profiles and show notes, and you can continue the conversation by joining our Facebook group. And if you enjoyed today's show, we hope that you'll subscribe and consider giving us a 5-star review. So for now, keep on working to elevate your trial law practice, and we'll see you back again soon.